DC.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McBee. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken Tuesday said Gaza's ceasefire deal needs to get done in coming days, adding the United States, Egypt, and Qatar will do everything possible to get Hamas on board.
We need to get the ceasefire and hostage agreement over the finish line, and we need to do it now.
Blinken, speaking to reporters in Doha, said once Hamas agrees to the proposal presented by Washington to tackle disagreements blocking a ceasefire deal, they would also have to get agreement on the implementation details. He said the U.S. has long said it does not accept the long-term occupation of Gaza by Israel. Airstrike hit an empty hotel on Tuesday in Gaza City, according to civil defense authorities. Thick smoke could be seen rising afterwards. Israel's military has leveled swaths of the Palestinian enclave since the start of the offensive in Gaza in October of 2023. Russian sources say that Ukrainian forces have either destroyed or damaged all three of the buildings over the same river in western Russia as Kyiv's incursion enters its third week. Kyiv's incursion into Russia's Kursk is now changing the trajectory of the war and boosting morale among Ukraine's war-weary population, though the ultimate outcome of their daring incursion remains impossible to predict. Also Tuesday, a massive fire burned for the third consecutive day elsewhere in western Russia after an oil depot was hit by Ukrainian drones. Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the Ukrainians of trying to destabilize the country, and he vowed revenge. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. The top UN official in Libya is warning that the political, military, and security situation in the oil-rich North African country has deteriorated quite rapidly, and without renewed political talks leading to a unified government and elections, there will be greater instability. Stephanie Gurry painted a grim picture to the Security Council on Tuesday of rival government forces unilaterally moving toward each other in July and August, sparking mobilizations and threats to respond and unilateral attempts to unseat the central bank governor and the prime minister in the country's west. India's Supreme Court created a hospital safety task force Tuesday to recommend steps to keep medical workers in the country safe days after a trainee doctor was raped and murdered on the job. Details from Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn.
The August 9th attack in Calcutta has caused national outrage and triggered demands for justice for the victim and greater safety for female healthcare workers. Doctors in several places have been refusing to see non-emergency patients. The court suggested the doctor-led task force consider sweeping reforms and new safety measures, such as separate resting rooms for female staff and the creation of employee panels to conduct quarterly safety audits. But hundreds of junior doctors who have been staying away from work in protest say they are not satisfied and will keep on demonstrating.
That's Reuters correspondent Christy Kilbourne reporting. Kenya and Uganda have ramped up their border screening process over the World Health Organization last week declaring the mpox surge in Africa a global public health emergency after the discovery of a new, more deadly, and more transmissible strain of the virus. Details from VOA's Jeff Custer.
Paul Kibi, port health officer at Kenya's Malaba Crossing on the border with Uganda, told the French news agency AFP when the WHO made its declaration last week, he and his staff heightened their awareness and adapted their processes. He said all travelers coming into Kenya from Rwanda, Burundi, southern Sudan, and Uganda must wash their hands thoroughly and then pass through their screening desk.
That is when we have a thermal scanner where it is able to pick the temperature of that traveler. So if the temperature of that traveler is high, if he has come from those countries which have reported this, the disease, then we do more information and we isolate that patient.
Custer, VOA News.
Dozens of former guerrilla fighters and their families have been forced to abandon a village in southern Colombia after receiving death threats from a rebel group that is still fighting the government. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
between Israel and Hamas.
In the interest of all concerned, starting with Israel, to bring this to a close.
Ukraine's incursion into Russia has lifted morale among its war-weary population.
In Russia, panic is spreading. Videos obtained by Reuters show fighter jets flying overhead near Suja.
And will Indian regulators call dead ball over cricket in a Disney-Reliance merger?
An initial assessment by India's antitrust body of the proposed $8.5 billion deal has concluded that it could harm competition due to both parties' power over cricket broadcast rights.
Today is Wednesday, August 21st.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strobe.
There is still no ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Tuesday said the Gaza ceasefire deal needs to get done in the coming days.
Our message is simple, it's clear, and it's urgent. We need to get the ceasefire and hostage agreement over the finish line.
Blinken repeated the point that the U.S. does not accept a long-term occupation of Gaza by Israel.
Time is of the essence. Time is of the essence because with every passing day, the well-being and lives of the hostages are in jeopardy. Time is of the essence because every single day, women, children, men in Gaza are suffering without access to adequate food, medicine, and at risk of being wounded or dying in fighting that they didn't start and they cannot stop. And time is of the essence because with every passing day, there's the danger of escalation in the region.
Kyiv's incursion into Russia's Kursk region is changing the trajectory of the war and boosting morale among Ukraine's war-weary population. Though the ultimate outcome of the incursion, the first attack on Russia since World War II, remains impossible to predict. More now from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed that the Ukrainian Defense Forces control more than 1,250 square kilometers of Russian territory and 92 settlements in Russia's Kursk region. According to Zelensky, this operation is the biggest investment in the process of freeing Ukrainians from Russian captivity. He noted that Ukraine captured the largest number of Russian prisoners in one operation, which is one of their main goals. Zelensky also noted that if the West had not imposed restrictions on the use of weapons on the territory of Russia, Ukraine would not have needed a physical intervention into the Kursk region to protect Ukrainian citizens in the border areas and destroy the potential for Russian aggression. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Russian authorities struggled Tuesday to put out a massive fire in the southern Rostov region for a third consecutive day after an oil depot was hit by Ukrainian drones as Ukrainian forces pushed deeper into Russia's Kursk region. VOA's Lori London talked with Doug Klain, non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, for some analysis about whether this is a major shift in the war.
Absolutely, this signifies a dramatic shift in the war. Western observers have spent months, maybe a year or so, thinking that this war has devolved into stalemate, into positional warfare rather than maneuver warfare, that Ukraine and Russia may now be stuck in trenches with full visibility of the battlefields thanks to drones and surveillance, and that no side could really do something big and shocking. Ukraine has proved that those assumptions were false.
President Zelensky said that if he was able to have used Western weapons deeper into Russia, that they wouldn't have needed to do that. Do you think that's really the case?
This has been one of the key asks that Ukraine has had of the United States in particular for months. The U.S. finally lifted some restrictions on using U.S. weapons inside of Russia when the Russian forces launched their Kharkiv offensive.
This has to be quite an embarrassment for Russia.
This is the first time since World War II that a foreign power has invaded onto Russian territory. And that is something that has happened on Vladimir Putin's watch.
It's one thing to watch your country invading its neighbor, and it's another to have it turned on you.
Ukraine is prosecuting this war in a very different way from how we've seen Russia prosecute it and persecute Ukrainian civilians. There was an excellent Washington Post report where Washington Post journalists this past week accompanied Ukrainian forces into Kursk and met with Russian civilians that were there and asked them how things were going and recorded things. You know, they saw Ukrainian forces distributing water and other humanitarian aid and supplies for people who had no power and needed food. There was a fascinating interaction that the journalists recorded where one Ukrainian soldier from occupied Crimea was interacting with some Russian civilians who said, "Why are you doing this? We're just innocent civilians. You know, you guys shouldn't even be here." And, you know, the Ukrainian responded something to the sense of, "You know, I used to think that too when I was still a civilian, and then you guys came and took my home from me."
Doug Klain, non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, talking with VOA's Lori London.
Germany and other G7 countries are developing ways to support Ukraine through loans financed with the proceeds of frozen Russian assets. The German finance ministry announced the effort on Tuesday. Latvia, once a sanctuary for Russian money, is a strong backer of the plan, as VOA's Miroslava Gungadze reports from Riga.
Jūrmalaya, the Latvian capital of Riga, used to be a top vacation spot for affluent Soviet citizens up to 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed. Then, as a new member of the European Union, Latvia offered a golden visa and a residency permit to those who opened a bank account and invested in real estate. It became a key EU entry point for wealthy Russians, says Sanita Jamberga, with the Baltic Center for Investigative Journalism.
People in Soviet Union used to come here, which was nostalgia, the windows of Europe, etc. And when we started to sell off properties and banks, then this is a street where you would meet every Russian oligarch you want to imagine who had a property here.
As an investigative journalist, Jamberga follows Russian money in Latvia. She says over the last two decades, Russians have created a beachfront sanctuary in Jūrmala.
It's a little Russia without Putin, let's put it this way.
She says Latvian law at the time allowed for the easy flow of Russian money in and out of the country. The scheme continued even after Russian invasion of Crimea. Paulis Lienkovs is the Latvia's top financial investigator.
Up until 2018, Latvia was indeed considered to be a money laundering haven.
But Ilyenko says things changed in 2018 after a report by the European Commission accused Latvia of not doing enough to fight money laundering. The U.S. also accused the Latvian bank of institutionalized money laundering and sanctions circumvention.
There was a very strong political commitment to very swiftly reform our financial system, and that was indeed done in a very short time frame. There was a lot of changes in the legislative framework. There was a lot of resources granted to the competent authorities to fight financial crime.
Latvia also reformed its financial sector, creating Latvia's Financial Intelligence Unit, which tackles money laundering and enforces EU and US sanctions related to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
We have published a list of every person whose funds have been frozen in Latvia based on sanctions, and not just directly designated individuals who are on the sanctions list, but also legal persons who are owned or controlled by sanctioned individuals.
157 individuals and accounts have been sanctioned in Latvia, totaling about $110 million have been frozen, says Lienkovs. The frozen assets include 74 real estate properties, including one in Jūrmala, owned by Mikhail Friedman, a Ukrainian-born Russian-Israeli tycoon.
This used to be a sanatorium, which was bought by Mikhail Friedman's company, and they wanted to make it into probably hotel and apartment place, because he is just 200 meters.
Earlier this summer, the foreign ministers of the three Baltic states, including Latvia, argued the G7 to work toward using frozen Russian assets for Ukraine's benefit. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Riga, Latvia.
We're following these other stories from around the world.
A man who confessed to killing 42 women and was being detained after the discovery of dismembered bodies has escaped from police custody. Police in Kenya say he and 12 others cut through wire mesh in the cells and scaled the perimeter wall.
The U.S. has imposed sanctions on the former president of Haiti following accusations that he abused his influence to facilitate drug trafficking into the United States and sponsored gangs that have contributed to instability in the Caribbean country.
Hundreds of LGBTQ plus people and their supporters have rallied in Nepal's capital during the annual Pride Parade, the first one since gay couples were able to register same-sex marriages officially in the Himalayan nation. The annual event brings together the sexual minority community and their supporters in Kathmandu during the festival.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, at night two of the Democratic National Convention, the highlight of the evening was a speech by former U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama and President Barack Obama. Joining us now from the Convention Center in Chicago is VOA's Kane Farabaugh. Let's start with the mood on night two in the convention hall. What's it like there?
Well, it's really energized. There's a lot of people here that were enthusiastic to make sure that they were present for the roll call vote, which is really the ceremonial or official way each state's delegates commit their votes to nominate Kamala Harris and Tim Walz as the presidential and vice presidential candidates. So a lot of people here are, you know, making sure that they were present on the floor so that they could be present for that roll call vote. And it was very theatrical. There were some musical performances. There was a DJ throughout the entire event that was playing music and getting the entire crowd pumped up as they cast those votes. And I have to say, you know, generally there's a lot of excitement and energy in the United Center here in Chicago.
The big event in the convention hall, I imagine, is the speech by former President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama.
Well, it absolutely is, and that's tonight's big event. But one thing that actually happened, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, they are in Wisconsin, which is the neighboring state here to Illinois. They are campaigning tonight in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a battleground state. It's a state that is a closely contested state. It has been in the last several election cycles. And so Wisconsin is a critical state for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz to win if they want to get to the White House. And so that's where they are tonight. And once the official tally was complete here on the floor of the United Center, when all of those delegates passed their ballots and it was clear that Kamala Harris was the nominee and Tim Walz with her, they went live to the event in Wisconsin. And Kamala Harris and Tim Walz walked out at their event in Wisconsin. And she spoke, and the crowd here in Chicago was able to see a live stream of them in Wisconsin. And so they actually got to hear from Kamala Harris here tonight. And so, you know, that was a part of the excitement early in the evening. But yes, the main event being former First Lady Michelle Obama and former President Barack Obama. You know, this Chicago is their home. This is their home state, their hometown. And so 20 years ago, Barack Obama was at the Democratic National Convention. And at that time, he was a state senator. He was a candidate for the U.S. Senate seat in Illinois, and it was the place where he was launched onto the national stage. It's where he gave a very powerful speech, and ultimately it's what launched his presidency. That was 20 years ago. So this moment for Barack Obama tonight, former President Barack Obama, is to sort of mark that anniversary and also provide the bridge between you know, his own presidency and legacy to Kamala Harris.
He probably still is the I don't know how else to say it, the rock star of the Democratic Party now.
You know, to a degree, you know, Barack Obama now is hasn't been in office for 8 years. You know, if anything, his wife is the rock star of the party. You know, she goes on book tours and sells out stadiums that come to see her talk, you know, when she's on a book tour. And, you know, in many ways, a lot of people have an affection for both the Obamas. But, you know, I think he even makes jokes about it when, you know, he talks about it. You know, she draws more of a crowd than he does, and she's able to sell more books than he does. So I think both the Obamas are definitely you know, members of the Democratic Party that are able to energize the base, energize the voters, and anytime they speak, it's something that Democrats pay attention to.
But that's very funny and great stuff. Thank you so much for talking to us from the convention. We will talk to you guys again Wednesday night. We'll hear from the vice presidential nominee, and then Thursday night, Kamala Harris will herself accept the nomination in a speech.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. VOA's Kane Farabaugh in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention.
The National Democratic Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to support democracy worldwide. Several officials from Ghana, Senegal, Nigeria, Sudan, and other African nations are in Chicago this week to observe the Democratic National Convention, learning how democracy plays out in America, even when it's messy. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more from Chicago.
Chris Famunya, Senior Associate for Africa and Special Advisor to the President of the National Democratic Institute, or NDI, says the U.S. Democratic National Convention is a unique chance for African officials to see up close how major political parties choose their presidential nominees and fine-tune their platforms, with delegates weighing in on the issues all the way until a platform is officially adopted at the convention, like it was here Monday night.
I've invited close to 200 internationals who are party leaders in their respective countries from Africa, Asia, Europe, Eurasia, Latin America to use this opportunity to see firsthand and experience the electoral process in the United States. What party conventions mean, how candidates are nominated, how they are voted upon.
Famunya says while there have been gains in the past two or three decades, African officials realize there's been a democratic decline over the past few years, and that it remains to be seen if lessons learned by African leaders attending this convention will rub off on other leaders where democracy is under threat.
Such as Sudan, which at one moment looked like they were on a transition towards a positive path, have now fallen back into civil war. Or countries such as Mali and Niger and Burkina Faso, which at one point looked like they were emerging democracies, are now being governed by military juntas. So there is definitely a decline, which is probably not only African, but we see also in other parts of the world that democracy is coming under attack.
Nigerian former Senate President Ken Nnamani, who was invited here by the NDI, says he and other officials say being in Chicago to see Democrats choose their presidential nominee and work on their party platform is an invaluable experience.
Unless you have watched it, you have seen it, you may be reading about it, but it's not the same as going to see the warmth, the excitement, and the general atmosphere.
Nnamani and the other African officials got a taste of that Monday night when they watched President Joe Biden step on stage to say that he has loved his job for the past 4 years, but loves his country more. In an historic move, the 81-year-old president stepped aside last month to allow his vice president, Kamala Harris, become the Democratic Party's presidential nominee. Nnamani says Africans can learn a great deal from the American system of democracy, especially when a page of history being made is rewritten by the people.
There's a lot that we are learning from, or we copied from the United States. So when you are doing anything that you are doing, it influences other countries. Almost all African countries are non-democratic, almost all. There may be some vestiges of those that are planting themselves permanently, like Cameroon. We have been expecting that there should be a new blood that can invigorate people and get the country going.
Both Nnamani and Famunya say observing the U.S. Republican and Democratic conventions this year can only help African leaders in their quest to support and strengthen democracy at home. Carol Van Dam at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois.
While the Democrats hold their convention in Chicago, former President Donald Trump visited a Michigan town on Tuesday.
We're here today to talk about how we are going to stop the Kamala crime wave that is going on at levels that nobody's ever seen before. And she is, as you know, the most radical left person ever even thought of for high office, certainly for the office of president. People don't know the real Kamala. But I do, and people that do what I do, they also know.
Just to fact-check that crime claim, the FBI's violent crime rate for 2022, the last year officially available, was 370 per 100,000 population. Since 1972, only 2 years have had a lower violent crime rate. That's 2014 and 2019. And preliminary estimates for 2023 show the violent crime rate continuing to fall. International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Shrope. Human rights organizations are reacting angrily after Zimbabwe's ruling party acknowledged that more than 100 activists were recently detained to keep them from protesting during a Southern Africa Development Community Summit held over the weekend. Authorities say they will only now start to release those who were detained. Steve Miller narrates the story from Columbus, Mavunga.
Speaking with journalists in Harare, ruling ZANU-PF spokesman Christopher Muschangwa defended the decision to detain the activists to prevent them from protesting at Saturday's Southern Africa Development Community, or SADC, summit in Zimbabwe.
Those are deviants, and they were dealt with properly. And we are very happy that they failed, and they will never succeed again. This was their last hint at misbehavior. They will never get another chance again, because now they know what happens when they try to behave in a certain manner.
Roslyn Hanzi, director of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, which is representing the activists, tells VOA that their detention is not a laughing matter.
Every person in Zimbabwe should be worried where the ruling party openly admits that it fully controls one of the key arms of government that is supposed to provide checks and balances, and in fact to protect the citizens from excesses of the other two arms of government, the legislature and also the executive.
Zimbabwe's Judicial Service Commission refused to comment Tuesday when contacted by VOA. Mary Lawlor, a UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights, called for the immediate release of the activists, alleging that some had been tortured during their arrest by Zimbabwean authorities. State prosecutors and the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission say they are investigating the allegations. Since taking over in 2017, President Emmerson Mnangagwa has maintained that he is a constitutionalist and respects the rule of law. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights say it hopes the detained activists will be released soon, now that the SADC summit is over. The group says that after hearing from activists, they will decide what steps to take next. For Columbus, Mpanga, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
And finally, India's antitrust body has reached an initial assessment that the $8.5 billion India merger of Reliance and Walt Disney Media assets harms competition because of their power over cricket broadcast rights. According to four sources who told Reuters on Tuesday, the deal could be in jeopardy. Lisa Bernhard has more.
It is the biggest setback so far for the planned Disney-Reliance merger, which aims to create India's biggest entertainment player. The combined company, which would be majority owned by Asia's richest man, Mukesh Ambani, would compete with Sony, Zee Entertainment, Netflix, and Amazon, offering a combined 120 TV channels and two streaming services. It would also have lucrative rights worth billions of dollars to broadcast cricket on TV and streaming platforms. That's prompted the Competition Commission of India, or CCI, to privately warn Disney and Reliance that their grip on India's favorite sport may be too tight, raising fears over pricing power and the combined company's potential sway over advertisers. Cricket has a fanatical following in India, the world's most populous country with an estimated 1.4 billion people. The CCI has asked both companies to explain within 30 days why it should not order an investigation. Reliance, Disney, and the CCI did not respond to requests for comment.
Reuters correspondent Lisa Bernhardt.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Strope, I'm Scott Wolterman.